used to hang around by the entrance nearest the river. Morton hadn't built his big gateway then, and watched the people come and go, asking who was who, and recognising them next time by the colours of their clothes and the animals and objects painted on their shields. "Don't stand about," people bellowed at him. "Make yourself useful!" Other children than he made themselves useful in the kitchen by fetching and carrying, their small fingers employed in plucking songbirds and hulling strawberries. Each dinner-time the household officers formed up in procession in the passages off the kitchens, and they carried in the tablecloths and the principal salt. His Uncle John measured the loaves, and if they were not just right, they were tossed into a basket for the lower household. Those that passed his test, he counted as they went in. Standing by him, pretending to be his deputy, he learned to count. Into the great hall would go the meats and the cheeses, the sugared fruits and spiced wafers to the Archbishop's table. He was not a cardinal then. When the scrapings and remnants came back, they were divided up. First choice to the kitchen staff, then to the almshouse and the hospital, the beggars at the gate. What wasn't fit for them would go down the line to the children and the pigs. Each morning and evening the boys earned their keep by running up the back staircases with beer and bread to put in the cupboards for the young gentlemen who were the cardinal's pages. The pages were of good family. They would wait at table and so become intimate with great men. They would hear their talk and learn from it. When they were not at the table, they were learning out of great volumes from their music masters and other masters who passed up and down the house holding nosegays and pomanders who spoke in Greek. One of the pages was pointed out to him, Master Thomas More, whom the Archbishop himself says will be a great man, so deep his learning already, and so pleasant his wit. One day he brought a wheaten loaf and put it in the cupboard and lingered, and Master Thomas said, "Why do you linger?" But he did not throw anything at him. "What is in that great book?" he asked. And Master Thomas replied, smiling, "Words, words, just words." "Master More is 14 this year," someone says, "and is to go to Oxford." He doesn't know where Oxford is, or whether he wants to go there or has just been sent. A boy can be sent, and Master Thomas is not yet a man. 14 is twice 7. "Am I 7? He asks. "Don't just say yes. Tell me, am I?" His father says, "For God's sake, Cat, make him up a birthday. Tell him anything, but keep him quiet." When his father says, "I'm sick of the sight of you," he leaves Putney and sets off to Lambeth. When Uncle John says, "We've plenty of boys this week, and the devil finds work for idle hands," he sets off back to Putney. Sometimes he gets a present to take home. Sometimes it is a brace of pigeons with their feet tied together and gaping bloody beaks. He walks along the river bank, whirling them about his head. And they look as if they are flying, till somebody shouts at him, "Stop that!" He can't do anything without someone shouting. "Is it any wonder," John says, "when you are into any mischief going, prone to giving back answers and always reliably to be found where you shouldn't be?" In a small cold room off the kitchen passages, there is a woman called Isabella, who makes marzipan figures for the Archbishop and his friends to make plays with after supper. Some of the figures are heroes, such as Prince Alexander, Prince Caesar. Some are saints. "Today I'm making St. Thomas," she says. One day she makes marzipan beasts and gives him a lion. "You can eat it," she says. He would rather keep it, but Isabella says it will soon fall to pieces. She says, "Haven't you got a mother?" He learns to read from the scribbled orders for wheat flour or dried beans, for barley and for duck's eggs that come out of the steward's pantries. For Walter, the point of being able to read is to take advantage of people who can't. For the same purpose one must learn to write. So his father sends him to the priest. But again he is always in the wrong, for priests have such strange rules. He should come to the lesson specially, not on his way from whatever else he's doing, not carrying a toad in a bag or knives that one's sharpening and not cut and bruised either from one of those doors called Walter, that he's always walking into. The priest shouts and forgets to feed him, so he takes off to Lambeth again. On the days when he turns up in Putney, his father says, "Where by the sweet saints have you been?" unless he's busy inside on top of a stepmother. Some of the stepmothers last such a short time that his father's done with them and kick them out by the time he gets home. But Cat and Bet tell him about them, screeching with laughter. Once when he comes in, dirty and wet, that day's stepmother says, "Who does this boy belong to?" and tries to kick him out into the yard. One day, when he is nearly home, he finds the first Bella lying in the street, and he sees that nobody wants her. She is no longer than a small-sized rat, and so shocked and cold that she doesn't even cry. He carries her home in one hand, and in the other a small cheese wrapped in sage leaves. The dog dies. His sister Bet says, "You can get another." He looks in the street but never finds one. There are dogs, but they belong to somebody. It can take a long time to get to Putney from Lambeth, and sometimes he eats the present, if it's not raw. But if he only gets a cabbage, he kicks it and rolls it and thrashes it till it's utterly, utterly destroyed. At Lambeth, he follows the stewards around, and when they say a number, he remembers it. So people say, if you haven't time to write it down, just tell John's nephew. He will cast an eye on a sack of whatever's been ordered in, then warn his uncle to check if it's short weight. At night at Lambeth, when it's still light and all the pots have been scoured, the boys go outside onto the cobbles and play at football. Their shouts rise into the air. They curse and barge into each other. Until somebody yells to stop, they fight with their fists and sometimes bite each other. From the open window above, the young gentlemen sing a part song in the high, careful voices they learn. Sometimes the face of Master Thomas More appears. He waves to him, but Master Thomas looks down without recognition at the children below. He smiles impartially. His white scholar's hand draws closed the shutter. The moon rises. The pages go to their truckle beds. The kitchen children wrap themselves in sacking and sleep by the hearth. He remembers one night in summer when the footballers had stood silent, looking up. It was dusk. The note from a single recorder wavered in the air, thin and piercing. A blackbird picked up the note and sang from a bush by the water gate. A boatman whistled back from the river. 1527. When the cardinal comes back from France, he immediately begins ordering up banquets. French ambassadors are expected to set the seal on his concordat. Nothing, he says, nothing will be too good for these gentlemen. The court leaves Beaulieu on the 27th of August. Soon afterwards, Henry meets the returned cardinal face to face for the first time since early June. "You will hear that the king's reception of me was cold," Wolsey says, "but I can tell you it was not. She, Lady Anne, was present. This is true." On the face of it, a large part of his mission has been a failure. The cardinals would not meet him at Avignon, made the excuse that they didn't want to go south in the heat. "But now," he says, "I have a better plan. I will ask the Pope to send me a co-legate, and I will try the king's matter in England." "While you were in France," he says, "my wife Elizabeth died." The cardinal looks up. His hands fly to his heart. His right hand creeps down to the crucifix he wears. He asks how it occurred. He listens. His thumb runs over the tortured body of God, over and over, as if it were any lump of metal. He bows his head. He murmurs, "Whom the Lord loveth?" They sit in silence. To break the silence, he begins to ask the cardinal unnecessary questions. He scarcely needs an account of the tactics of the summer just past. The Cardinal has promised to help finance a French army, which will go into Italy and try to expel the Emperor. While this is happening, the Pope, who has lost not just the Vatican but the Papal States, and seen Florence throw out his Medici relatives, will be grateful and obliged to King Henry. But as for any long-term rapprochement with the French, he, Cromwell, shares the scepticism of his friends in the city. If you have been in the street in Paris or Rouen, and seen a mother pull her child by the hand and say, "Stop that squalling, or I'll fetch an Englishman," you are inclined to believe that any accord between the two countries is formal and transient. The English will never be forgiven for the talent for destruction they've always displayed when they get off their own island. English armies laid waste to the land they move through, as if, systematically, they performed every action prescribed by the codes of chivalry and broke every one of the laws of war. The battles were nothing. It was what they did between the battles that left its mark. They robbed and raped for 40 miles around the line of the march. They burned the crops in the fields and the houses with the people inside them. They took bribes in coin and in kind, and when they were encamped in a district, they made the people pay for every day on which they were left unmolested. They killed priests and hung them up naked in the marketplaces. As if they were infidels, they ransacked the churches, packed the chalices in their baggage, fueled their cooking fires with precious books. They scattered relics and stripped altars. They found out the families of the dead and demanded that the living ransom them. If the living could not pay, they torched the corpses before their eyes, without ceremony, without a single prayer, disposing of the dead as one might the carcasses of diseased cattle. This being so, the kings may forgive each other, the people scarcely can. He does not say this to Wolsey, who has enough bad news waiting for him. During his absence, the king had sent his own envoy to Rome for secret negotiations. The cardinal had found it out, and it had come to nothing, of course. "But if the king is less than frank with me, it does nothing to aid our cause." He has never before met with such double dealing. The fact is, the king knows his case is weak in law. He knows this, but does not want to know it. In his own mind, he has convinced himself he was never married, and so is now free to marry. Let us say his will is convinced, but not his conscience. He knows canon law, and where he does not know it already, he has made himself expert. Henry, as the younger brother, was brought up and trained for the church, and for the highest offices within it. "If His Majesty's brother Arthur had lived," Wolsey says, "then His Majesty would have been the cardinal and not me. Now there's a thought. Do you know, Thomas, I haven't had a day off since I was on the boat, I suppose. Since the day I was seasick, starting at Dover." They had once crossed the narrow sea together. The cardinal had lain below, calling on God, but he, being used to the voyage, spent the time on deck, making drawings of the sails and rigging, and of notional ships with notional rigging, and trying to persuade the captain, "Yourself not offended," he said, "that there was a way of going faster." The captain thought it over and said, "When you fit out a merchant ship of your own, you can do it that way. Of course, any Christian vessel will think you're a pirate, so don't look for help if you get in difficulties. Sailors," he explained, "don't like anything new." "Nor does anyone else," he said. "Not as far as I can see." There cannot be new things in England. There can be old things freshly presented, or new things that pretend to be old. To be trusted, new men must forge themselves an ancient pedigree like Walter's, or enter into the service of ancient families. Don't try to go it alone, or they'll think you're pirates. This summer, with the cardinal back on dry land, he remembers that voyage. He waits for the enemy to come alongside, and for the hand-to-hand fighting to begin. But for now he goes down to the kitchens to see how they are getting on with their masterpieces to impress the French envoys. They have got the steeple on the sugar-paste model of St. Paul's, but they are having trouble with the cross and ball on top. He says, make marzipan lions. The Cardinal wants them. They roll their eyes and say, will it never end? Since he returned from France, their master has been uncharacteristically sour. It is not just the overt failures that make him grumble, but the dirty work behind the scenes. Squibs and slanders were printed against him, and as fast as he could buy them up, there was a new batch on the street. Every thief in France seemed to converge on his baggage train. At Compiègne, though he had mounted a day-and-night guard on his gold plate, a little boy was found to be going up and down the back stairs, passing out the dishes to some great robber who had trained him up. What happened? Did you catch him?
The great robber was put in the pillory. The boy ran away. Then one night, some villain sneaked into my chamber and carved a device by the window.
And next morning, a shaft of early sun, creeping through mist and rain, had picked out a gallows from which dangled a cardinal's hat. Once again the summer has been wet. He could swear it has never been light. The harvest will be ruined. The king and the cardinal exchange recipes for pills. The king lays down cares of state, should he happen to sneeze, and prescribes for himself an easy day of music-making or strolling, if the rain abates, in his gardens. In the afternoon, he and Anne sometimes retire and are private. The gossip is that she allows him to undress her. In the evenings, good wine keeps the chills out, and Anne, who reads the Bible, points out strong scriptural commendations to him. After supper, he grows thoughtful. Says he supposes the King of France is laughing at him. He supposes the Emperor is laughing too. After dark, the King is sick with love. He is melancholy, sometimes unreachable. He drinks and sleeps heavily, sleeps alone. He wakes, and because he is a strong man and a young man, still he is optimistic, clear-headed, ready for the new day. In daylight, his cause is hopeful. The cardinal doesn't stop work if he's ill. He just goes on at his desk, sneezing, aching and complaining. In retrospect, it is easy to see where the cardinal's decline began. But at the time, it was not easy. Look back and you remember being at sea. The horizon dipped giddily, and the shoreline was lost in mist. October comes, and his sisters and Mercy and Joanne take his dead wife's clothes and cut them up carefully into new patterns. Nothing is wasted. Every gobbet of cloth is made into something else. At Christmas, the court sings,
as the holly groweth green, and ever changes hue, so I am and hath been unto my lady true. Green groweth the holly, so doth the ivy. The winter blasts blow ever so high. As the holly groweth green, with ivy all alone, when flowers cannot be seen, and greenwood leaves be gone. Green groweth the holly.
Spring, 1528. Thomas More, ambling along, genial shabby. Just the man, he says. Thomas Cromwell, just the man I want to see. He is genial, always genial. His shirt collar is grubby. Are you bound for Frankfurt this year, Master Cromwell? No. I thought the Cardinal might send you to the fair to get among the heretic booksellers. He is spending a deal of money buying up their writings, but the tide of filth never abates. More, in his pamphlets against Luther, calls the German shit. He says that his mouth is like the world's anus. You would not think that such words would proceed from Thomas More, but they do. No one has rendered the Latin tongue more obscene. Not really my business, Cromwell says. Heretics' books. Heretics abroad are dealt with abroad, the church being universal. Oh, but once these Bible men get over to Antwerp, you know. What a town it is. No bishop, no university, no proper seat of learning, no proper authorities to stop the proliferation of so-called translations. Translations of scripture, which in my opinion are malicious and willfully misleading. But you know that, of course. You spent some years there. And now Tyndale's been sighted in Hamburg, they say. You'd know him, wouldn't you, if you saw him? So would the Bishop of London. You yourself, perhaps. True, true. More considers it. He chews his lip. And you'll say to me, well, it's not work for a lawyer running after false translations. But I hope to get the means to proceed against the brothers for sedition, do you see? The brothers, he says. His little joke. He drips with disdain. If there is a crime against the state, our treaties come into play, and I can have them extradited to answer for themselves in a straiter jurisdiction. Have you found sedition in Tyndale's writing? Ah, Master Cromwell. More rubs his hands together. I relish you, I do indeed. Now I feel as a nutmeg must do when it's grated. A lesser man, a lesser lawyer, would say, I have read Tyndale's work, and I find no fault there. But Cromwell won't be tripped. He casts it back. He asks me, rather, have you read Tyndale? And I admit it, I have studied the man. I have picked apart his so-called translations, and I have done it letter by letter. I read him, of course I do, by license, from my bishop. It says in Ecclesiasticus, he that toucheth the pitch shall be defiled, unless his name's Thomas More. Well, now, I knew you were a Bible reader, most apt. But if a priest hears a confession, and the matter be wanton, does that make the priest a wanton fellow himself? By way of diversion, More takes his hat off and absently folds it up in his hands. He creases it in two. His bright, tired eyes glance around, as if he might be confuted from all sides. And I believe the Cardinal of York has himself licensed his young divines at Cardinal College to read the sectary's pamphlets. Perhaps he includes you in his dispensations, does he? It would be strange for him to include his lawyer, but then it's strange work for lawyers altogether. We've come around in a circle, he says. More beams at him. Well, after all, it's spring. We shall soon be dancing around the Maypole. Good weather for a sea voyage. You could take the chance to do some wool trade business, unless it's just men you're fleecing these days. And if the Cardinal asks you to go to Frankfurt, I suppose you'd go. Now, if he wants some little monastery knocked down, when he thinks it has good endowments, when he thinks the monks are old, Lord bless them, and a little wandering in their wits, when he thinks the barns are full, and the ponds well stocked with fish, the cattle fat, and the abbot old and lean, off you go, Thomas Cromwell, north, south, east or west, you and your little apprentices. If another man was saying this, he'd be trying to start a fight. When Thomas More says it, it leads to an invitation to dinner. Come out to Chelsea, he says. The talk is excellent, and we shall like you to add to it. Our food is simple, but good. Tyndale says a boy washing dishes in the kitchen is as pleasing to the eye of God as a preacher in the pulpit or the apostle on the Galilee shore. Perhaps, he thinks, I won't mention Tyndale's opinion. Moore pats his arm. Have you no plans to marry again, Thomas? No? Perhaps wise. My father always says choosing a wife is like putting your hand into a bag full of writhing creatures with one eel to six snakes. What are the chances you'll pull out the eel? Your father has married, what, three times? Four, he smiles. The smile is real. It crinkles the corner of his eyes. Your beadsman, Thomas, he says as he ambles away. When Moore's first wife died, her successor was in the house before the corpse was cold. Moore would have been a priest, but human flesh called to him with its inconvenient demands. He did not want to be a bad priest, so he became a husband. He had fallen in love with a girl of 16, but her sister, at 17, was not yet married. He took the elder so that her pride should not be hurt. He did not love her. She could not read or write. He hoped that might be amended, but seemingly not. He tried to get her to learn sermons by heart, but she grumbled and was stubborn in her ignorance. He took her home to her father, who suggested beating her, which made her so frightened that she swore she would complain no more. And she never did, Moore will say, though she didn't learn any sermons either. It seems he thought the negotiations had been satisfactory, honour preserved all round. The stubborn woman gave him children, and when she died at 24, he married a city widow, getting on in years and advanced in stubbornness, another one who couldn't read. There it is. If you are so lenient with yourself as to insist on living with a woman, then for the sake of your soul, you should make it a woman you really don't like. Cardinal Campeggio, whom the Pope is sending to England at Wolsey's request, was a married man before he was a priest. It makes him especially suitable to help Wolsey, who, of course, has no experience of marital problems, on the next stage of the journey to thwart the king in his heart's desire. Though the imperial army has withdrawn from Rome, a spring of negotiations has failed to yield any definite result. Stephen Gardiner has been in Rome with a letter from the cardinal praising the Lady Anne, trying to disabuse the Pope of any notion he may entertain that the king is being wilful and whimsical in his choice of bride. The cardinal had sat long over the letter listing her virtues, writing it in his own hand. Womanly modesty? Chastity? Can I say chastity? You'd better. The cardinal looked up. Know something? He hesitated and returned to his letter. Apt to bear children? Well, her family is fertile. Loving and faithful daughter of the church? Perhaps stretching a point. They say she has the scriptures in French set up in her chamber and lets her women read them, but I would have no positive knowledge of that. King Francois allows the Bible in French. She learned her scriptures there, I suppose. Ah, but women, you see, women reading the Bible, there's another point of contention. Does she know what Brother Martin thinks is a woman's place? We shouldn't mourn, he says, if our wife or daughter dies in childbirth. She's only doing what God made her for. Very harsh, Brother Martin, very intractable. And perhaps she's not a Bible woman. Perhaps it is a slur on her. Perhaps it is just that she's out of patience with churchmen. I wish she did not blame me for her difficulties, not blame me so very much. Lady Anne sends friendly messages to the cardinal, but he thinks she does not mean them. If, Wolsey had said, I saw the prospect of an annulment for the king, I would go to the Vatican in person, have my veins opened, and allow the documents to be written in my own blood. Do you think, if Anne knew that, it would content her? No, I don't think so.
But if you see any of the Boleyns, make them the offer. By the way, I suppose you know a person called Humphrey Monmouth?